WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. The UN Security Council today is considering Secretary General Kofi Annan's plan for inspecting sensitive presidential sites in Iraq. Inspection teams have successfully visited two of these sites since the Secretary General's negotiations with Saddam Hussein last week. Jonathan Tucker is the director of the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Project at the Monterey Institute of International Studies in California. He's also served as an arms control fellow at the U.S. State Department and as a member of a U.N. weapons inspection team in Iraq in 1995. He inspected a large facility in the desert outside of Baghdad, which the U.N. found suspicious. I asked him why the U.N. targeted this site.
The plant in question was known as Al-Hakam. It was 55 kilometers southwest of Baghdad, or about an hour and a half by bus. This facility had been linked to Salman Pak through an organizational link. And the Iraqis actually declared it when they provided a list of all of their fermentation sites throughout Iraq. But they claimed that it was engaged in strictly civilian activities, the production of a bacterial pesticide to kill caterpillars on crops, and of a single-cell protein material, which was, they claimed, being used as a supplement for animal feed to feed chickens. And in fact, all of the equipment at this site was dual use, which means it was legitimately engaged in production of civilian products, but could also be used to make biological weapons in the very same fermentation vessels. And in fact, this is a problem with verification of any treaty to ban biological weapons, because much, if not all, of the equipment does have potentially civilian applications. So there's a great deal of ambiguity involved. But there were a number of suspicious factors, but it was not until the defection of Hussein Kamel, that's Saddam Hussein's son-in-law, who was the mastermind behind the biological weapons program, that the UN Special Commission was able to find compelling evidence that this facility, Al-Hakam, was in fact Iraq's premier biological weapons production site.
It sounds as if the tricks that Iraq or other countries use to camouflage biological production facilities, that they're not very easy to see through. Is that true?
Yes, that's true. That is the dilemma in detecting and eliminating biological weapons programs, because they can be very easily concealed in civilian facilities. And developing countries do have a legitimate need to produce vaccines, to make single-cell protein, to produce biological pesticides. And in fact, biotechnology has provided many benefits to the developing world in terms of improved public health and improved agricultural yields. But at the same time, it does have a dark side. The same technology that is providing real benefits can also be used to produce biological weapons, and can provide a cover, and a seemingly legitimate civilian cover, for a military program. So this is not only a problem that is unique to Iraq, it is a problem that is quite pervasive in the developing world.
How do you clean up a biological weapons facility if you want to avoid being found out in one of these inspections?
Well, the best way, actually, of finding clandestine biological weapons production at a facility like Al-Hakam, which is ostensibly commercial, is to take samples. And sometimes a producer is careless and is sloppy in the production techniques and may leave telltale indicators of illicit production. In a more sophisticated facility, it is easier to clean up the fermentation vessels, for example. In the most sophisticated fermentation facilities, there is what's called clean-in-place technology, where the fermentation vats can actually be sterilized in place rather than disassembling them over a period of hours or days. This facility at Al-Hakam was not that sophisticated, and so that the inspectors took samples from the production line, and although they did not find anthrax or other obviously incriminating indicators, they did find some anomalies that suggested to them that illicit production might be taking place. And those anomalies were found in the biopesticide production line. Iraq was producing a bacterium known as Bacillus thuringiensis, or BT. This is a bacterium that is produced throughout the world as an insecticide. The bacterium contains tiny protein crystals that kill insects. But when the UN inspectors took samples from the Iraqi BT production line, they determined that the bacteria did not contain those crystals, so that Iraq was ostensibly producing a bacterial pesticide that had no pesticidal activity. That was the first anomaly. And the second anomaly was when the inspectors took samples from a spray dryer at the end of the production line, which was producing a dried bacterial product that could then be spread on crops. They determined that the particle size of the powder was too fine, actually, to be applied to crops because it would not settle out of the air. It would just remain suspended in the air. Yet that particle size was ideal for production of a biological weapon, which would be disseminated by creating an aerosol or a suspension of microscopic particles that could then be breathed in by the victims. So it seemed there was at least a strong suspicion on the part of the inspectors that Iraq was trying to develop the technology at Al-Hakam to produce a dried anthrax that could then be disseminated as an aerosol. So under the very noses of the inspectors, and as a ostensibly civilian activity, Iraq was apparently developing a new form of anthrax that would be even more deadly.
What do you think of the recent agreement that UN Secretary General Kofi Annan negotiated with Iraq? It set up a special inspection team, which includes diplomats, and they allegedly have access to the disputed sensitive sites in the country. It sounds from everything you've said that this is a highly, highly technical specialty, and that including diplomats in the inspection process somewhat politicizes the issue.
Well, that has clearly been Iraq's goal, is to weaken the role of the UN Special Commission, which is a scientific and technical organization, and to give an increasing role to the UN Security Council, because Iraq does have some friends on the Security Council, and they would like to play off those friends against the United States and the UN Special Commission, basically weaken the role of the technical inspectors under Mr. Butler. But that having been said, it all depends on the actual arrangements that are negotiated for the participation of diplomats in the inspection teams. And of course, the diplomats would only participate in inspections of so-called presidential sites, of which there are 8 declared in Iraq. These are really a small minority of the sites of interest to the UN Special Commission. I mean, there is some potential concern about setting a precedent that Iraq might try to extend the special arrangements negotiated for the presidential sites to other sensitive sites. But the UN Special Commission has made it very clear that it would strongly, strenuously resist any effort by Iraq to do so.
What lessons do you draw from the UN experience in Iraq about how to go about monitoring and inspecting biological and chemical weapons production in non-cooperative nations around the world?
The UN Special Commission has engaged in extensive detective work, and they've been particularly effective in the auditing, for example, of import and export data, in using interviews with Iraqi officials to uncover discrepancies and to home in on defective cover stories and force the Iraqis to admit these programs over a period of time. I think the primary lesson is that one is generally not going to find a smoking gun, unequivocal evidence of biological weapons. In fact, the UN Special Commission has not found a single filled biological munition. But at the same time, they've been able to use, for example, discrepancies in Iraqi imports of culture medium used to grow bacteria, of which there was there were 17 tons of culture media that the Iraqis could not explain, discrepancies in the Iraqi cover stories, which began to crumble. And all that forced the Iraqis to begin to admit the existence of a large-scale production program, although they denied weaponization. And it was not until the defection of Hussein Kamel that the Iraqis finally decided to come clean, or were forced to come clean, and admit very large-scale production of biological weapons.
Jonathan Tucker is the director of the Chemical and Biological Weapons Non-Proliferation Project in Monterey, California. He served as a UN weapons inspector in Iraq in 1995. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Jonathan Tucker. He served as a UN weapons inspector in Iraq in 1995. He directs the Chemical and Biological Weapons Non-Proliferation Project in Monterey, California. Ken Alabek is a defector from the Soviet Biological Weapons Program. Our other guest in this show, Richard Preston, talked to him extensively. He claims that the Russians continue to develop new biological agents. How credible do you think his information about the Soviets' biological weapons program is?
Well, Mr. Alabekov defected from this former Soviet Union in 1992. So I think his information up to 1992 is quite accurate. I don't know what his sources are with respect to the current status of the program, and I would be somewhat cautious in terms of that information. But I think he does have excellent information about what actually went on in the so-called biopreparat complex, which was an ostensibly civilian production complex for vaccines and other legitimate pharmaceuticals that was also engaged in clandestine military research and development and production.
What does your organization now believe is the Soviet stockpile of biological and chemical weapons?
I don't think that there is strong evidence that there is an actual stockpile. I think the concern is more about the capability to produce these agents in wartime. We know, for example, that during the Soviet-Russian program, there were a number of mothballed production facilities. The best known one was known as Stepnogorsk in what is today Kazakhstan, that had the capability to produce very large quantities of anthrax and other lethal agents, if given the order within six months, so that in case of war or a crisis, these facilities could easily gear up for large-scale production of biological agents. But one thing about biological agents is that they don't store very well indefinitely, that they would generally be produced to order shortly before a conflict. The United States, for example, when we had an offensive program, we had to continually replenish our stockpile of biological agents because after a while the agents themselves lost their virulence or just died and had to be replaced. So these are not, unlike chemical weapons, which if they're produced in pure form can be stored almost indefinitely. So for that reason, it's more likely that a biological program would have a capacity to produce the agents. All the research and development in the seed cultures would have been done, and the agents would be produced to order in a crisis or wartime situation.
Do you have concerns that the United States might be involved in researching and developing biological weapons?
I don't think that the United States is actively involved in offensive biological weapons research and development. However, we do have a very active defensive program, that is a program to develop vaccines and protective gear to protect troops against biological weapons. And there is some level of ambiguity. I mean, to develop effective defenses, one has to do research and development to some extent on offensive agents and test the defenses against the offensive agents. So there is some potential level of ambiguity, and perhaps some of the research and development involved in developing defenses would provide additional information about offenses. And that is somewhat unavoidable. I think the only way around that ambiguity is to increase openness and transparency with respect to such defensive activities.
Are the methods at our disposal for dealing with a chemical or biological weapons accident or attack effective?
Well, there is now much greater concern ever since the Aum Shinrikyo incident in March of 1995 that terrorists might actually acquire these weapons and use them. And in recent years, there has been a program on the part of the U.S. government to increase our preparedness for dealing with these incidents. The program is just getting up and running. So if there were an incident tomorrow, we would not be prepared. But I think there's a very comprehensive effort underway to improve the preparedness of not only the federal government and the various federal agencies to deal with these contingencies, but also local and state governments. There is a training program by a number of U.S. government agencies at the 120 largest cities in the country to train first responders. These are the police, fire, and emergency medical services that would really be the people on the front lines in trying to deal with the consequences of a chemical or biological attack. But a lot more needs to be done, and the effects of a chemical attack would be very different from a biological attack. In a chemical attack, there would be immediate casualties. It would be very clear that something terrible had happened, and the main problem would be to protect the first responders from becoming casualties themselves, decontaminating the victims, administering antidotes, and getting them to hospitals. In the case of a biological attack, because there is a delay, an incubation period before people come down with symptoms, one might not even know that an attack had occurred for several days. And the only indicator would be a lot of people suddenly come down with nonspecific symptoms and start showing up at hospital emergency rooms or personal physicians complaining of flu-like symptoms. So one would have to develop sophisticated disease surveillance techniques or epidemiological surveillance mechanisms to detect an outbreak at the early stages when the disease is treatable, and then have stockpiles of antibiotics in place so that large numbers of people could receive therapy in time to save them from the illness. So that, I think the problem of dealing with biological terrorism is much more complex than dealing with a chemical incident.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us today on Fresh Air.
Oh, I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Jonathan Tucker directs the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Project at the Monterey Institute of International Studies. This is Fresh Air.